Chapter 15, Communication. The key to stopping sex trafficking is an electric fence. Several lifetimes ago, when I was teaching presentation skills at Hewlett-Packard, a woman in our class named Kristen Clark said something I've never forgotten. My physicist brother says, "Give me a lever and a place to stand and I'll move the world." I say to him, "I'll do something even harder. Give me 1,000 words and I'll change an attitude." Communication can indeed change an attitude, or for that matter, save a career or launch a product. Communication is as much about speaking, putting it out, as it is about listening, taking it in. So let's consider listening skills from across a wide spectrum: psychology, business, politics. Silicon Valley CEO Rick Wallace got some stinging feedback from his boss about his communication style. He considered it a present.
So when I came to KLA, my job was to take over the apps lab, and I immediately started putting in systems in place to try to get that job to become a different job. But people viewed that I was elbowing them out of their jobs, and so I think the feedback that I got was, you know, you're viewed as being arrogant and self-centered. And it was Gary Dickerson, one of the best things he ever did is he called me in his office and he says, "I have a present for you." And he gives me this negative feedback. And I said, what? Why is that a present? He goes, "Well, most people won't tell you and you can benefit from it." It's like, yep. And if, you know, part of the whole thing was, look, if you don't know that you're being perceived that way, how are you possibly going to make
it? For Gloria Steinem, listening is how problems get solved. In the following story, she describes how the problem of sex trafficking in an African village was solved with an electric fence. Listening was the key.
It took me a long time to realize it, but I lived in India when I first got out of college, and I spent a few weeks walking through villages with a Gandhian team that were trying to stop a riot that was going on then. And they used to just say that to me, but I didn't understand it was applicable in this country for many years. They used to just say to me, okay, if you want people to listen to you, you have to listen to them. If you want to change how they live, you have to go where they live. If you want, you know, and it's true everywhere. I had just gone in Zambia to a big conference about sex trafficking. I was going to visit friends who live along the Zambezi River. They had arranged for me to meet with village women, about 30 or 40 village women, sitting on the ground in a field. I thought, okay, this time it may not work, this circle thing, because we're just so different. But it did, of course. Finally, after a couple of rounds, one of the women started talking about how her husband beat her, which she wasn't supposed to say, and then everybody else started to tell the truth. So a couple of them had gone to Lusaka, ended up being sex trafficked, and never came home. So I said, well, what can we do about that? And they said, well, if we could grow enough maize to have a cash crop, we would have food security and we could pay our kids' school fees and we wouldn't have to do that. I said, well, okay, how could you grow enough maize? They said, well, if we had an electrified fence around a lot of acres, because otherwise the elephants come in as soon as the maize comes and eat it. And right. So I raised money for an electrified fence. It wasn't that much, a few $1,000s. The fence got built. I went back the next year. They had a bumper crop of maize, enough to sell to have their kids' school fees besides their own food. They were singing songs to the maize. They're, you know, dancing under the trees to the maize. We're celebrating the maize. If you had asked me, what is a cure for sex trafficking? I never would have said an electrified fence. So this is why we need to listen.
If listening is so powerful, why isn't it done more often? We're trained in school about how to prepare our arguments. We learn how to write and how to speak, but rarely about how to listen. On the other hand, to be understood can be literally life-changing. George Elton Mayo of the Harvard Business School one time commented, "A person who truly understands, who takes the trouble to listen to us as we consider our problem, can change our whole outlook on the world." George Dahm. Several years ago, I worked with a former commanding officer of the Blue Angels, George Dom. He was preparing for a TEDx talk about leadership. We worked on the standard issues of storytelling, tight organization, takeaway messaging. Of course, he talked about the importance of commitment, trust, discipline, etc. What surprised me, though, was how much he focused on the interpersonal problems of the team. He described what happened to morale when two pilots had serious disagreements and began to detest each other. With wingtips just 18 inches apart at speeds of 400 miles an hour, trust of your leader and of the other team members is a life and death issue. His job at that point, as the team leader, wasn't just about the technology of high-speed drills, but of the sloppy area of emotional intelligence. He worked with his two pilots over a period of time to help them talk through the issues and learn to listen to each other and to rebuild a working relationship, if not a friendship. The team continued to function as it should, performing at the highest level. The next year, when I saw the Blue Angels streaking across the sky above San Francisco, I remember that what made that show possible, in addition to technical flying skills, was pilots being able to really listen to each other. Types of communication. In business and in life, communication takes many forms. How we communicate with our spouse, our parents, our children, or our boss or a customer may all be quite different. But I see communication falling into two broad buckets. Competitive communication, where the goal is to win and to force the issue. Or, then there is cooperative communication, where the goal is more collaborative. Let's consider some examples of competitive communication. Larry Lippert. Ironworker supervisor Larry Lippert is what we might call an in-your-face communicator.
You kind of have to remember that in this trade, as you're a supervisor, you're also surrounded by a bunch of alpha males. We're all alphas, you know, and the bottom line, though, is that if you're too nice, your guys will walk on you, and if you're too much of a fucking dick, they won't do shit for you. You know, they'll fuck you every time your back's turned.
I'm doing an article for the Harvard Business Review on management based on Larry's ideas. The title of my article is Don't Be Such a Fucking Dick. I mean, it simplifies management, you know, right there, right? Just pretty straightforward.
When I broke in this trade, everybody was a screamer. You know, it seems that nowadays, if you scream at somebody, oh my God, they want to call a lawyer and sue you for some kind of, you know, harassment or whatever, man, but it's all part of hand in hand. If you're young and you want to be an iron worker, you better have some thick skin, be able to put your head down and run your ass off all day. Otherwise, it may not be for you. If you're a little sensitive and you're afraid of being yelled at and you don't know how to work hard, this is not the trade for you.
Another example of the in-your-face competitive communications is what happens when senior leaders of major corporations, called the C-level executives, get together for a strategy planning session when not everyone is on the same page. When making a video for our Speaking to Executives DVD, we got a group of 8 executives together and asked them to demonstrate what such a meeting was like.
This is internal training for our $100,000
in a training.
Steve, try this about revenue enhancement.
Why are we
not
having this discussion, Dan?
It's another pet project.
Is this another one of Dan's? This is an area where we continue to underinvest.
No.
Yes, absolutely.
Follow a training dollar to a revenue line. Nobody's ever done it.
Exactly. Right on. Yes.
That's just another pet project.
That's because nobody ever does it. Nobody ever spends money on training.
It's a sociological impossibility.
We shouldn't be spending any money.
Imagine trying to get that group to come to an agreement on anything. Another example of this competitive communication style was told to me by John Kispert, who you met in Chapter 13 on mentors. Here's what he said. So I was giving my quarterly finance report to our top leadership. As had happened in 3 previous occasions, Bob, a peer from product development, began challenging my numbers in a derisive manner. I walked over to him, paused, and said, "Bob, you do this to me every time I present. I'm goddamn sick of it. This is my presentation, and I plan to finish it. If you have something to say to me, you can do it after this meeting is over, but for now, I want you to shut up." John had played college football and presented an imposing figure. He said the room grew deathly quiet. Bob sank in his chair. And then John said, "As I scanned the room, I could see the looks of approval on the executives' faces. 6 months later, I was promoted to CFO. 2 years after that, I was president of the company." John retired as CEO of a 10,000-employee Silicon Valley technology company. Another Silicon Valley executive, Karen Sage, explained why there can be no let-up in the rough and tumble of getting up the corporate ladder. She told me, "At the executive level, you're always upping the game higher and higher. If you don't, you're out." I hear people say, "I got to the director level and I don't need to go any higher." Usually those people are pushed out in a few years by aggressive up-and-comers who show more promise. You can stay at the same level if you're an individual contributor, though you may still be at a high risk of lower cost workers pushing you out. But in management, you better be reaching for and achieving the next level, or eventually people are going to push you out. I thought after hearing that, too bad that more senior management wannabes don't hear Karen's advice early in their careers. Might save a lot of broken dreams. From cooperative to competitive. I remember meeting an up-and-coming female executive in one of our classes on speaking up to executives. As she moved up the ranks of management, she told us, she was proud of her supportive communication style with her subordinates. Now though, as she was getting up in the management chain toward a position at the C level, she told our whole class that her style was changing. "I have so much pressure on me these days, I don't have time to hear what's bothering people, and frankly, I just don't care." Then came the bombshell. "As I'm moving up, I'm becoming a real asshole. I wish it was different, but this is where I want my career to go, and these changes go with the territory." The rough and tumble, hard-edged, in-your-face style of communicating can be successful. But so can a gentler style I call cooperative communication. We can see this style in business, in interpersonal communications, and in politics. For example, Gloria Steinem creates an inclusive communication style even in large audiences by creating trust that allows for deeper sharing.
We can learn stories, we can identify, we can do all kinds of things on the page or the screen, but we don't have that extra boost of empathy. And I discovered that in rooms, you know, that people, it's like a kind of magical communication.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd be in a place with 5,000 people in the audience, and if you make a place for it to happen, then you can pretend you're sitting in a circle. You have to really listen to each other. And I try to, in the beginning, say, you know, pretend you're not all looking at each other's backs and, you know, this is hierarchical setting, forget about that, pretend we're in a circle. And if you have enough time, somebody over here will ask a question and somebody over there will answer it. People will say things they wouldn't say to their closest friends and relatives because it makes a force field in the room. It's just, it's a magic event.
Congresswoman Anna Eshoo believes that how she shows respect by really listening to constituents is one of the things that's made her successful in Congress.
Well, I think that it's important to develop relationships with people. But what I'm mindful of and keep reminding myself of is that you need to be kind to people when you're speaking to them, that you need to be respectful of them. So it's not about me, you make it about the other person. Just as I have to listen and listen very carefully to constituents and what they say so that I can be in their shoes. And so I've been successful at many of my undertakings, I think, because it's the way I've operated, the way I've spoken to people. In many ways, it's the way I want to be treated. I don't want to be taken for granted.
Summary. When we consider how Larry the Ironworker and Anna the Congresswoman communicate, their styles could not be more different. One is in your face, and the other is empathic. Which is the best way? Dumb question. It's all situational. Imagine Anna yelling at fellow House members to get a bill passed, or Larry practicing active listening to get a 2,000-pound beam put in place. They both get results. Larry gets the skeleton of a huge building put in place, and Anna gets legislation through Congress. Larry gets things done through the men he supervises. When I had a wine and cheese reception for the ironworkers, everyone was invited, but Larry waited until the very end to show up. He wanted the spotlight on his men, not on him. Similarly, when Anna had a huge celebration of her 25 years in Congress in 2017, Nancy Pelosi, who emceed the event, commented, "You all love Anna, but do you know how much she's admired in the U.S. Congress? Look around. Of the 250 people here tonight, there are 8 members of Congress who came to celebrate Anna. That doesn't happen." It reflects how well she's thought of in Washington. My style. The interviews I've included in this audiobook are drawn from hundreds I've done over the past 3 decades. My style of interviewing has grown out of my experience as a patient in psychotherapy and as a therapist. I found that what I really liked about therapy was being listened to. Therapy offers that like nothing else in life. Then as an encounter group leader and as a therapist doing one-on-one therapy, if I created the space where people felt heard and not judged, magic happened. But that's not all. Active listening is the key. It says, hey, I'm really hearing what you said. Not judging, not giving advice, just listening. That creates trust, and people are willing to be vulnerable. In my interviews, for example, some say things they've never told anyone. Some cry, especially when they're talking about their mentors or their role models, or their children. Being listened to is a precious gift. Throughout this audiobook, when you hear me speaking, I'm often doing active listening. It creates trust. You can hear people relax and start saying more, going deeper. There's nothing magical about these interviews, though magic often happens. It is simply the process of building trust. Listening is the key. Summary. With Chapter 15, Communication, we come to the end of Phase 2 of our lives, adulthood. This phase contains the major part of this audiobook, 11 chapters. In our lives, the ages between roughly 30 and 60 are the most challenging. In childhood, we're getting ready. And in elderhood, we're looking back and trying to figure out what the hell happened. But in adulthood, we face the real challenges, careers, making a living, successes, failures, marriages, money, divorces, parenthood or not, losing our parents, dealing with medical issues. The list goes on and on. Recent research in developmental psychology has revealed some startling findings. Adulthood is the most unhappy phase of human life for many people. This is where the rubber meets the road. And sometimes the failures and disappointments make these years some of the worst. Turns out we are happier in childhood and in our elder years. You know, it makes sense. In those decades, we don't have the pressures that we have in our adult years. So now we turn our attention to phase 3 of our lives, elderhood. This is the time when we evaluate what we've done. The developmental research I mentioned has shown that for many people, these are the happiest times of their lives. This is a time for looking back and connecting the dots. It's a time to sum it all up. We consider how we can pass on what we've learned to the next generation. Rather than the competition we experience in our adult years, now we focus on legacy, inspiration, building community and kindness. So, empathy and kindness are the focus of Chapter 16.